So the first noble truth tells about that. And again, it isn't meant for us to feel depressed about it, or in any way feel unhappy about that. It is meant for us to see it for what it is, accept it, and then practice. It's a spur to practice. Without the understanding of dukkha, we don't have enough urgency. Samvega in Pali has not enough urgency, because a person who is not very negative will constantly live in the hope that something nice is going to happen. And something nice will happen eventually. And so they look for the nice things to happen instead of practicing. It happens to most people. And until the day that one is finally convinced, this isn't going to do it either. I've got to practice. The second noble truth belongs to the first one. And it says there's only one single reason for dukkha, and that's craving. Craving also means, of course, wanting to get rid of. It doesn't just mean wanting to have, it means wanting to get rid of. And that's exactly what I've just said. There's always something that should be different. We aren't totally fulfilled. But when the Buddha speaks about craving, he means three exact things, three particular things. And the main thing is, or the two main things, the craving for sensual gratification and the craving to be. Now we've talked about already about the craving to be. The third one is the craving not to be, which is only the other side of the same coin, and which arises when things go entirely wrong and we say, oh, I'd rather be dead. It doesn't change anything. As long as we think it's me being dead, we haven't changed a thing. In fact, all we have done is become negative. That's all. So we shouldn't think ever, which is also done sometimes, that the opposite of the craving to be, which will result in letting go of the craving to be, is the craving not to be. Should never think like that, because it's the same mistaken view as the craving to be. There's got to be somebody there for to be, and there's somebody there not to be. So we can't eliminate our craving to be just by wanting to be dead. And besides, we've already discussed that the only thing that dies is the body anyway. So we're not changing anything. The opposite of the craving to be is to let go of the me illusion. That's the answer to that. So, it's one sentence which takes lifetimes to actualize. I would say, and I always think, that those people who do come to the meditation courses have had lifetimes of practice, and that they have a very good chance at this point in time to get rid of that illusion. In fact, I often sort of play with this imagination that we were all there when the Buddha was talking and it didn't go in. We heard it, but we didn't do it. So here we are again. And now we hear it, and this time we might do it. It's possible. 2,500 years is not a very long time as far as humanity or the universe go. Meantime, of course, we've been around several times, many times. So this is only a personal imagination. There's no basis in fact for any of that, what I just said. But I sometimes think like that. And I also, a little bit of basis in fact comes about because sometimes I get the feeling as if I had known some of the people that come to the courses, and actually they are the ones I'd never seen before. So that type of thing does happen, and I think everybody has that kind of experience, the déjà vu, that we have seen somebody and actually we don't know that person at all. These are all past lifetimes connections, and if these past lifetimes connections are useful in the spiritual path, by all means follow them up. But if they're not, go wide far away from them. They only bring the same karmic entanglement that they did in the past. Very difficult to sort out. The second noble truth then has those three cravings as the underlying factor of its statement. But what we really experience is that when we want something, we have dukkha. And when we don't want something, we have dukkha. And that needs to be investigated, experienced, lived through, and changed. Every time we want something, we are experiencing a lack. Otherwise, we wouldn't want it. So there's something missing, and we think we're going to get it. If we only got this thing, or this person, or this result, we'll be fine if we get that. And then we get it. And how long are we fine? Immediately, the mind makes up a new lack. Something new. It gets babies. Makes up new things. And then we got to do that again. And then we get that, and then we have to do another one. So we should see that the wanting is dukkha, because it manifests as a lack. It also manifests as the insecurity of whether we're going to get it, and the insecurity whether we can keep it. None of that is sure. And with the we don't want something, it's very easy, because that's rejection. And that, of course, is not happiness producing. It's very easy to see that. So actually, this is how mankind lives. Humanity lives like that, wanting and not wanting. And the whole day is usually spent with that kind of emotion. Even though we do all sorts of things physically or even mentally, we still have those emotions. And if we notice those and become aware of them, that will actually tell us what dukkha is. It's not tragedy, it can be, it's not losing what the very important people, it is that. These small things that happen day in and day out. And even though we may have a very good situation to live in, and most likely everybody here does, there's still dukkha. And it's nobody's fault. It just is. Now, then, when we can recognize it for what it is, we will also recognize how we usually deal with it. The most popular way of dealing with dukkha, I've already mentioned several times, we find a scapegoat. Very often that scapegoat is the person we live with. Physically near, best known, and very easy to use. If we don't like to do that because we have realized that it creates disharmony, we use a person that's a little further removed physically. If we can't find the person, we use situations that must be at fault. This is our most popular way of dealing with dukkha. It doesn't get us anywhere, it goes around in a circle. And we have already talked about that. But we also have other means of dealing with dukkha. And the most famous one, or the most used one, and the one that the Buddha said overshadows dukkha so that we don't see it anymore, is movement. Now you can see that in the sitting position. If it becomes very unpleasant, we move. Or in sleep, obviously the body becomes uncomfortable, there's no doubt about it. So the mind makes it move. Movement is that which creates a veil over dukkha. A movement not necessarily physical, and in a sitting position it would be physical. Or going on a journey, going to a different country, seeing different sights. Tourism is a result of dukkha. Also creates dukkha, of course, but it's a result of dukkha. And just that we know that isn't going to stop anybody. It's just going to continue. Because people think by moving they can change their dukkha. And they do. They change the dukkha from one to another dukkha. It's very easy to see when people travel. They've got all sorts of things they've got to look after. And none of them are very pleasing. And then they finally see some very interesting sight. And so that's an interesting sense contact. So all our movements, everything we do, and this is something that really needs to be investigated, is designed to take us out of dukkha. Now that makes short thrift of our idea that we want to help others. We want to, there's no doubt about it. And we can, if we give them what we've got. But it is still, underlying all, it's still that movement. Movement from one thing to another. Because just sitting in our room, maybe, and contemplating dukkha, people who have not accepted it as part and parcel of life itself will get more dukkha. Instead of being able to go out and do something which appears to be good. That does not mean that the Buddha said not to do that. Go right ahead. Helping others is the most important thing to do. But he said, find out what's underlying all. Underlying all is dukkha. Because when we think, for instance, when we think of another person, we can't think about our own dukkha. So it's very helpful. The same goes for generosity, which is the first of the 10 virtues which the Buddha recommended to practice. And the first one is always one which opens the door, so to say. A generosity means that we're thinking of another person. So we don't have to think about our own dukkha at that time. We don't even have to feel that little niggling feeling within which tells us that we haven't quite got what we really want. We're concerned now with the well-being of another person. Very good. Or we should do that. But should know that it's only a cover. A cover-up. When we realize that it's a cover-up, it doesn't mean that we stop doing it. When we realize it's a cover-up, we realize what dukkha really is. Dukkha is the identification with a special, separate entity. That's our dukkha. Now, we have talked about that, the identification, and this is underlying the whole thing. That's underlying the craving to be, and that's underlying, of course, our sensual gratification. So that is dukkha. And everything we do, everything, is designed to quieten this underlying knowledge so that it doesn't become so pronounced that we actually know it. When we actually know it, we've got to do something about it. And most people are so habituated to being somebody and becoming somebody. Whatever they do, they want to become somebody, that the mind doesn't really like to admit that this is the cause of all dukkha. When we have meditated successfully and have been able to experience the higher jhanas, we have a momentary experience of nobody being there, but it's very momentary, and we still have an observer, so we still have something to identify with, but we have a little bit of an example of what it could be like. So that will usually also spur on the practice and the underlying third hindrance of sloth and torpor will be less pronounced, because we know there is something that can be done. So we have a very good way of finding out whether the Buddha's words are correct or not. He said, everything that exists is dukkha, and there's only one cause, and that's craving. Is it true? Can we find it? Can we find that cause and realize it's dukkha? If we can't, we really need to do more contemplation on that. Because the Third Noble Truth then says that there is a way out of dukkha, a complete elimination, which is called Nibbana. In Sanskrit, Nirvana, in Pali, Nibbana. Literally translated, Nibbana means non-burning. Doesn't mean non-I, it just means non-burning. No passion. But there we come across a difficulty which again and again people find hard to overcome. I would like to get out of dukkha. But in order to get out of dukkha, I've got to let go of I. It's like a paradox, isn't it? The Buddha said, there is a deed but no doer. There is suffering but no sufferer. There is a path but no one to enter. And there is nibbana but no one to achieve it. That doesn't mean that nobody can reach nibbana, on the contrary. But it means that in order to experience even a smattering of it, which one does in the first two path moments, there has to be a momentary total elimination of any identification. Now, in order to get to that maybe come a little nearer, draw a little nearer to that. One needs to inquire about one's own death, which we have talked about already, and see whether one is willing to be dead now, right now, but not because life is terrible, life is awful, but because one is willing to let go of everything that constitutes life for oneself, which is a totally different ballgame. The two have nothing in common. And then, having a look to see what one is clinging to and hanging on to, which makes it impossible to be dead now. Which is one way of looking to see where the difficulty lies. We can use our death, but we can also use the imagination for Nibbana. I explained already that every architect needs a blueprint. We need a blueprint. And we need more than the blueprint of the Buddha's words. We need a blueprint in our own mind. What do we think it's like? What could it be like to be without this me? Can we have an idea that to be without me would be absolutely wonderful, heaven, or whichever words we like to use, a great boon, real peace, whatever word you like, doesn't matter. Can you imagine not having any me within for just a moment? If there's no me, what do you want to become? There's nothing to become. We already are. And this is what drives everybody, becoming someone. There's an awful lot of pressure on. We think somebody's putting the pressure on. The boss, or the cost of living, or the enormous traffic. Whatever we think puts the pressure on. None of that has anything to do with it. We put the pressure on. We put the pressure on to become somebody. And the minute we have 1 second, or even 1 millisecond, of not identifying with anybody in there, but just being there, the pressure is off. There's no pressure. We don't have to become anything. Now, of course, the me comes back right away, doesn't it? And as it comes back, the only pressure that we should allow to be on is the pressure to practice, so that the me will eventually finally disappear. The person without that identification is of benefit, so the Buddha said, to the whole of humanity. It's the enlightenment principle which does not disappear. The personality of the one who has had that experience disappears, of course, at death. But the enlightenment principle always stays around. And so there is a possibility, and the Buddha said this is not only a possibility, but it's a fact, that one person becomes enlightened, helps the whole of humanity. When I visited the holy places in India, the holy places are those which where the Buddha had some important happening and which he recommended that one should visit. The first one one usually goes to is Lumbini, his birthplace. And there's nothing much there to admire. And I found the place, just the place. I wasn't overwhelmed by anything. I just thought, oh, well, that's nice. This is where he was born. And that's what the legend says. And there's a column there put up by King Asoka with writing on it saying that the Buddha was born there. And then we went to other places where he gave his first discourse, in Bodh Gaya, where he became enlightened, and Isipatana, where he gave his first discourse. And eventually we wound up in Kusinara, which is where he died. And there is a stupa there which was built over his cremation place. He was cremated there. And then the stupa was built over it. It's half ruined, but half there. And what one usually does is one circumambulates this stupa. Walks around it with one's right shoulder towards the stupa. That's a traditional way of honoring this place. And as I did that, I felt enormous energy coming through my feet, from the ground, up through my feet, all the way up to the crown of my head. And I thought, gee, that's interesting. And having finished circumambulating, which takes probably 5 minutes or maybe less than 5 minutes, I came out to the front again, and we were a group of 80 people, of whom at least half had never meditated in their lives. And all 80 were sitting there meditating. And nobody had said a word about it, including some kids, 12 years, 10 years old. They were all sitting meditating. And I thought, oh, well, that's lovely. We'll sit down too. So we sat down and meditated. And then, when we finished that, I had some of my Sri Lankan students there with me. And one of them said, gee, I felt this enormous energy here. And then the other said, yes, we did too. And then they said, and how come we didn't feel that at Lumbini? Why are we feeling it here? And I quickly thought, and I said, yeah, but in Lumbini, the Buddha wasn't enlightened. He was born there, but he wasn't enlightened. And here in Kusinara, he was fully enlightened. So it wasn't just me feeling that, it was these ladies that I talked to. There were six of them, I think. Six or eight, I can't remember. Felt exactly the same. And everybody else must have felt something, because they all sat down and were meditating. 80 people, right there on the ground. And I don't know what they did in their meditation, but they all looked very peaceful, which is not easy to do in India, to look peaceful. It's quite a difficult terrain to travel in. So that has strengthened my understanding. This particular happening has strengthened my understanding that the enlightenment principle of one person, well, of course, the Buddha is especially strong, but of any person, is there for all of us to relate to if this is our direction. The same as I said about the universal or cosmic consciousness. Whatever we have in here, we can actually gain support from the cosmic consciousness as an echo. We all have the seed of enlightenment within. We can gain support as an echo, if that's our direction. So it is not out of the question to have an idea We're usually full of ideas. I mean, we've got ideas what we want to eat, we have ideas how we want to entertain ourselves, we've got ideas whom we want to be with, we have ideas where to travel to. Why not have an idea what it's like to be enlightened? I mean, what stops us from that? I can see no good reason at all. I mean, our head is full of ideas, everybody's head. So why not have a useful idea like that? So what could it possibly be like to be there and not feel that this is me, but just to be there? And obviously one can imagine that one wouldn't have to react. One wouldn't have to react to anything, because there's nobody there. That, of course, the Buddha also reacted when he wanted to. He chose to react so that people would know what they were supposed to do and what not to do. In fact, his monks behaved so badly one time, doing all sorts of very bad things, that he said, all right, that's enough, I've had enough. I'm going in the forest, and you can look after yourself, fend for yourself. And he did. So he reacted. But because he wanted to give them a lesson, reacted when he wanted to. So if there's nobody in there, we don't have to react to all these bits and pieces that happen constantly to everybody. Everybody has constant things happening within. Watch them, look at them, become aware of them. Imagine what it's like to be enlightened. Preferably during one's lifetime. Okay, well, stand up and stretch our legs. And to start, we'll put the attention on the breath for just a few moments. First thing I'd like you to do is investigate within yourself whether you can find your most prevailing underlying mood, the one that you most often encounter. Which then gives rise to thought and emotion. And if you can find that underlying mood and be aware of it, I'd like you to change it to one of equanimity, ease, acceptance, and now I'd like you to have a look at any dukkha within yourself that you are aware of at this moment. If you haven't got one at this moment, something that you'd rather have different from the way it is, then anything that can come up in your memory that happened yesterday, the day before, a week ago, any dukkha that you have felt, bring it back up. And then find the craving, the wish, that whatever it is that creates dukkha should be different. That it shouldn't be the way it is. And then drop the wish and let it be. And as you drop the wish that it should be different, can you recognize that the dukkha disappears as long as the wish has disappeared? Now look at anything in your life, whatever it may be, that you don't find satisfactory. That creates dissatisfaction. And as soon as you found it, whatever it may be, or several things, drop the wish that they should be different and see whether there is relief and release. And now investigate, what is it that you're most attached to, clinging to, which prevents you from the actual acceptance that we could all be did today? What is it that is your most definite clinging? Take a good look at it. The opposite of clinging is not indifference. It's being at ease, equanimity, acceptance. Now, having found that which is your most definite clinging, can you realize whether this clinging gives you happiness or not? If it doesn't give happiness, can you for a moment imagine that you drop that clinging, that it's not yours, it's neither me nor mine, it just is existence. Now take a look at the dukkha in the world. Anything you can think of, not difficult. There's so much of it. Try to see how it comes about. What is it that makes people create dukkha for others? What is it in that person? Why do people react with dukkha? Have a look at whatever you can think of. And now have another look. Can you think of anyone that doesn't have dukkha? Any dukkha at all? Anyone you know? Now come back to yourself and investigate and have a look. What you usually do or have done in the past in order to lighten the dukkha or eliminate it momentarily or not having to confront it. What are your usual patterns? Can you realize that all of these actions of movement in mind or body or both are designed to overshadow dukkha? Can you see it? And now have a look whether you can agree with the Buddha's enlightenment statement that existence is dukkha, not just because you believe him, because you've seen it, that there's only one cause, that's craving, and that the answer is the elimination of the me illusion. Can you say so because you've seen it, or is it still a matter of confidence in the Buddha?